You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Professor Jennifer Curtin this morning. Kia ora, Jennifer. How are you?
Kia ora, I'm good, thank you.
It's good to have you on the show today. It's been a very busy time. Let's start with the polls, because they're looking very tight heading into the election. We're still a wee way away from it, but it is definitely starting to be something people are paying a bit more attention to. What do you think this closeness is actually saying about voters' behaviours or thoughts at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose one thing I would say about polls generally is that this is very much about driving, you know, something the media needs to hang on to before the parties start releasing policy and the other things they can talk about in the lead up to an election. But yes, it certainly is tightening. I mean, everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people are already predicting that it's going to be a National Act alliance, but there's also an argument out there that the two major parties are really trying to hug the centre, and what opportunities then there are for the smaller parties around the outside. So Roy Morgenthau, for example, had Pāti Māori surging up to close to 7%. They have other polls have them at 3%, maybe, and Winston Peters' party is coming back around 3.5%. Top is still there in the mix, and of course the Greens, Sora Phillip, in the last poll, I think, with TVNZ. So there's a lot of movement. There's also 12% undecided, and that's still quite a high number. So you know, it's still if we're going to use sporting metaphors, it's still a race. But I think what we need to recognise about the ACT National Bloc is that's, you know, at 46% is what Bill English took National to in 2017, and they weren't able to form the government then with ACT. ACT has surged at the expense, to be honest, of New Zealand First and of National. So there's been a lot of circulation, I think, of support on the right. It's what's happening on the left, I suppose, the centre-left, that we're going to have to watch in order to, if people want to see a countering of that.
So what do you think we need to see from Chris Hipkins' government, particularly at the moment, if Labour wants to grab that centre vote more with two hands, perhaps?
Yeah, I think what he's doing is he's shifted the party more to the centre, you know, with his bread and butter type politics, and he's leaving some of the nutty, gnarly issues that aren't going to win him election to one side, like a wealth tax or a capital gains tax and those sorts of things, and leaving that space. So that's a space, I suppose, that the Greens can pick up, because they, both major parties, cannibalise the side party's votes. So I think Hipkins is hugging the centre very well. It's just that it's not particularly inspirational for the 12% perhaps undecided, or for the new voters coming into the electorate. So remembering that we had a lot of new voters last time round, young people who turned out, we don't have two referendum this time. Single issue voting is often much easier, and that first vote is really important. So whether Hipkins has the capacity to inspire first-time voters to get to the booth, which is actually really important for the centre-left and the left, because, you know, history shows that younger people tend to be more progressive than their older counterparts.
It's an interesting thing, as you sort of mentioned at the top, the discussion around polls. There is a school of thought that argues a lot of, prevaricating in the media around predicting who might take it out can have actually an adverse effect on particular groups turning out to vote. Do you have any thoughts on that at all, particularly when it comes to young people when we are heading into an election?
Well, I think one of the motivators of turning out to vote for people who are, you know, less likely to be party identifiers, we call them, you know, like wedded through their core values to only vote for the same party.
Mm.
It's about 60% of the electorate that's sort of like that. But the new voters coming in are still to sort of formulate that identification or may choose to be issue-based. And I think that the challenge with the polls is, and, you know, is that if they're talking it up and predicting, then people feel that their vote isn't going to make a difference, and so why bother? And that is a risk, because we need to feel that that sense of efficacy, that what we do mm-hmm. will have some kind of relevance and meaning, not just for us personally, but to sort of have a flow-on effect. And yeah, so I think I haven't read the research on how polls suppress turnout, but it wouldn't surprise me if there is some because of that lack of efficacy that can come as a result of just feeling it's a foregone conclusion and it's not very competitive.
Mm. Well, I guess if there's anything to be seen really from the polls at the moment, it is that it's looking very, very tight. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how turnout affects that as well. But let's talk a wee bit about Australia and New Zealand. It's obviously a sort of collaborative time for our two countries, with the FIFA Women's Football being co-hosted between us at the moment. Anthony Albanese is in Aotearoa right now for football, but they're also talking about other things, him and Chris Hipkins. What do you think is going to come out of the conversations, particularly around tourism? We're hearing quite a bit about that at the moment.
Yeah, so last week was the Australian-New Zealand Leadership Forum, when a couple of hundred business leaders, politicians, and other interested groups, including Indigenous businesses from both sides of the Tasman, came together for a day and a half of conversations about where to take the closer economic relationship and the relationship more broadly further. And so this sort of rounds that out. So some of the issues talked about by the two leaders yesterday afternoon reflect that, but I think there's a lot more probably going on behind the scenes. So we know that they were talking about, and this has been sort of a perennial problem, is that travelling across the Tasman is as difficult as travelling to Europe and back in terms of filling out forms and going through customs. And so they want to see, and businesses and frequent travellers who do business across the Tasman want to see what they call a seamless border. So there's a sense that they want us to feel like we're getting on a domestic flight rather than an international flight. And Australian business people really hate filling out the 3-page customs declaration or something. But this is not going to be as easy as they say. They have to, both countries have to agree on the biosecurity element. So there's that. But there's also the defence element. So we know that Australia is much more committed to, you know, AUKUS, to submarines, to defence spending. They spend twice as much in terms of percentage of GDP than we do. And there might be, behind the scenes, a bit more pressure on us, especially since Secretary of State is also down from the US to celebrate the Women's Football World Cup. So there'll be other things that I think we'll probably hear about from this visit. But at the moment, they're, of course, championing the bonds, the tires, and, you know, the post-pathway to citizenship. Apparently 10,000 New Zealanders in Australia have applied for citizenship now, which is great. There's a lot less ministerial discretion being utilised on the 501 send home, which under the previous centre-right government was utilised quite a lot.
Mm.
So it's a healthy relationship, whether or not it's this big picture, long-term economic benefits remains to be seen.
Just briefly before we let you go, Jennifer, I do want to touch on some of the major headlines this week have been, of course, around Kiri Tapu Allen's resignation, and also a lot about the conversation of that particular pressure that our MPs are put under in the spotlight of an election year, but also just in that role. Do you have any thoughts about that? Not specifically Kiri Tapu, but more about that particular lens of pressure that we see on our MPs?
Yeah, I think this is. I think that it reveals to us how, you know, colonial and historically, I would say, hyper masculine and quite toxic our parliament is. And how foreign and alienating it must be for many people who aspire to doing, you know, public service through political representation, because it's in addition to Kitty Allen, we've had Elizabeth Kirikiri, Meka Waitari and Louisa Wall all leave, you know, so Wahine Māori are, you know, exiting, but others have gone as well, with struggles relating to the workload, the alcohol, and the intensity of the media spotlight and so on. So there's sort of nothing left of their lives that's private, and perhaps Jacinda Ardern felt it the most. But I think what's really interesting or challenging here is that we don't see very much commitment from the sort of parliamentary officers themselves to try and really revolutionise the culture and transform it in a way that becomes more welcoming and doing politics differently in the House. So I don't know what the resolution is, but it doesn't bode well for young Māori and other young, you know, aspirational politicians who want to do things differently, because it isn't particularly welcoming. Hours are really long. The whipping, you know, that's just the term. The whip, you know, they have to stay there until 10 p.m.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of pressure, and I think, yeah, it's something that we really do need to have a serious conversation about, maybe as a country. We probably should have had that conversation a while ago as well. But thank you so much for your time this morning, Jennifer. It's great to have you on the show. Have a lovely rest of your morning, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Kia ora, thanks. Bye.
Kia ora. Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.